thank you, Commissioner Bishop, and that is one item of business that we should try to get to by the end of today as a subcommittee, voting on a chair, or at least talking about it, thinking about it, and then maybe we come back next time. But in the meantime, I'm going to function informally and try to leave this discussion facilitated. So we'll just jump, should we do introductions real quick? Why don't we start? I'm Will Soifer, not a board member of the Drexel Board.
Dan Hoffman, I'm sitting in today for Commissioner Malcolm. I'm Assistant Commissioner of Health and Protection with Indiana.
Steve Kelly, I'm the Department of Commerce, a member of the CPD.
Kristen Ivey Collison, Citizen Member of the Environmental Board, Walton Board.
Margaret Anderson Kelleher, Commissioner of MnDOT.
Peggy Walkie, Citizen Member.
Laura Bishop, Commissioner of Minnesota Pollution Control.
Hi, Al Forsberg, Citizen Board Member of Drexel District Number 1, Cross Suburbs, Minnesota.
Sarah Stroman, Commissioner of the DNR. I apologize, I have my back to all of you.
I'll watch your back.
I trust these folks. I just feel like that's better.
We'll experiment a little bit with the layout here as we try to recognize. We want this to be a little bit less of a formal conversation, a little more inviting for everybody, but we're really sure how many people show up. So we will work from here. Anyways, why don't I just jump right into it? Again, Will Soifer, Director of the Board. I'm going to tag team this presentation with Denise Wilson. I want to jump in. We want to kind of make sure we start from the basics here. This is how we get this to work. Okay, great. Perfect. We're on. So just the objectives for the meeting today. Really the goal today is just to start and establish establish a foundational understanding of the program, the Environmental Review Program, just so we're all working from the same point. We're not going to spend too much time on this, but I think it's a critical piece just to make sure we all have clarity over role, functionality of the program, the role of the subcommittee within that context, talk a little bit about the future meeting framework, how we're going to go about doing our charge, and then we want to spend most of the time really discussing the current practice for environmental review and climate. What is the current state of play? What are some challenges and opportunities in that? And then leave some time for public input. Okay, as we move through the agenda, just some questions. Really what we're hoping to hear from board members and the public as we ramp up to our next meeting and the meeting thereafter is what information, additional information that you're not hearing today do you need to really be able to evaluate this and make decisions? Who else that is not here would you like to hear from on this so we can ensure that we put them on future agendas? And then any other thoughts about next steps for further discussion? And then the last piece, as I mentioned earlier, we'll want to elect a chair, and the role for that chair is going to be to preside over subcommittee meetings and also to approve and propose an agenda with staff. Okay, so we'll just kind of start at phase one here. This environmental review kind of comes from the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act. So we've talked a little bit about NEPA before, but 116D02 is the Declaration of State Environmental Policy. It's projected up here on the screen. And then 116D04 directs the board, EQB, to by rule establish categories of actions for EISs, EAWs, as well as exemptions. Okay, so the board undertook that activity years ago and produced Minnesota Rules Chapter 4410. This is the chapter of rules that is all things environmental review. And environmental review then delegates the project-based review to RGUs and defines those RGUs. I just want to read from the environmental review purpose statement I'm going to violate what I should be doing when I do a slideshow, but I think this language is important. This is from the purpose statement in the environmental review. The Minnesota Environmental Policy Act recognizes that the restoration and maintenance of environmental quality is critically important to our welfare. The Act also recognizes that human activity has a profound and often adverse impact on the environment. A first step in achieving a more harmonious relationship between human activity and the environment is understanding the impact which a proposed project will have on the environment, and the purposes of parts 0200 to 6500, which is the whole chapter, is to aid in providing that understanding through the preparation and public review of environmental documents. I just want to hit on a couple of those points. This is a first step in achieving the condition that's declared in the Environmental Policy Act, and this is about the preparation and public review of other environmental documents. So if you move on through environmental review and the rules, there are five objectives that are defined and established in the rule. The first is to provide usable information to the project proposer, governmental decision makers, and the public concerning the primary environmental effects of a proposed project, to provide the public with systematic access to decision makers, which will help to maintain public awareness of environmental concerns and encourage accountability in public and private decision making. The third is to delegate authority and responsibility for environmental review to the governmental unit most closely involved in the project. The fourth is to reduce delay and uncertainty in the environmental review process. And the fifth is to eliminate duplication. And those might read like they're mutually exclusive. They're not. Our challenge is to find that balance and meet those objectives. And those are defined in the rule. So some other just high level characteristics of the program that I think are just important for us to know as we begin to talk about it and think about where does climate fit into this question. First off, environmental review is broad in scope. This is distinct from permitting, which is narrow to one pollutant and mitigating. This is a broad look at a project or type of development. There is a prohibition on governmental action while environmental review is underway. So this is an important feature of the program, that there is a moratorium on any governmental approvals and construction of a project while environmental review is underway. Projects don't pass or fail environmental review. This is often misunderstood about the program. You don't get a permit or a no through environmental review. You have to come to a finding at the end of an EAW that assesses whether there is a potential for significant effect. If you make a negative declaration, then you move to permitting. If you make a positive declaration, then your decision on an EIS is the review. Was it adequate? Did it adequately cover what was scoped into the environmental review document? And so those are important decisions, but not in those decisions is the question, is this a yes or a no? But you do have to go through that process for projects that meet the threshold requirement. There is a defined public process, which is unique to this program. The comment, response to comment, it informs project proposers, RGUs, and the citizens early in the process. And then finally, it has a feature that is really important, which is an opportunity for citizens. So those are some high-level features of the environmental review program. So I just want to get into a little bit about roles and clarifying roles of the program at large. And so these come from our rules explicitly. The EQB shall monitor the effectiveness and shall take appropriate measures to modify and improve their effectiveness. And the EQB shall assist governmental units and interested persons in undertaking and implementing the rules. So I'll talk a little bit about that notion of monitoring effectiveness, what does it mean, how do we go about doing it, but that's our primary charge, is oversight and assistance. Then RGUs, the charge is that RGUs shall be responsible for verifying the accuracy of environmental documents and complying with environmental review processes in a timely manner. So we oversee the program at large. RGUs, project by project, are accountable for verifying the accuracy of environmental documents. And then there is an appeal process created that decisions by an RGU on the need for an EAW, need for an EIS, adequacy of an EIS, adequacy of an AUAR, are may be reviewed by declaratory judgment action within 30 days of the RGU's decision. So there is judicial review. So that is often a question. The board does not have a role in that piece of it. That goes to judicial. So that's to try to better understand the roles. This breaks it down a little bit deeper into what does that mean. I'm going to just kind of highlight this document in front of you. This even gets into greater specifics, just about what are some of the tools at your disposal to actually accomplish that charge. I'm not going to get into all of these here, but please read them as you can. We highlighted some of the bigger ones. The board has authority to approve rule changes, direct rule changes, alternative forms of review. So these are categories of review that some that are approved currently are transportation projects, energy projects, energy facilities, alternative EAW forms. So there is an alternative EAW form for feedlots. And then the chair has the authority to make changes to the EAW form itself. The role of staff is then to develop guidance on behalf of the board to make sure these rules are understandable to RPUs and public. We do rulemaking on behalf of the procedural steps of rulemaking on behalf of the board. We provide the day-to-day assistance, and we report periodically to the board on data and program effectiveness. So I'm going to jump. That green box tries to capture what we as a subcommittee are doing, which I tried to build out a little bit more on this slide. But really, what our task here is to, we're going to consider program data. We do annual reports on data and previous program evaluations, ongoing historical. We're here to provide a forum for RGUs to bring forward issues, trends, concerns. And then we, as a subcommittee, will be periodically making recommendations to the full board to go and carry out its duties. So what is, I think this is an important slide here just to think about. You know, we have this big charge of monitoring the effectiveness of the environmental review program. What does that mean? You know, explicitly, we interpret it as meeting the objectives that are defined in rule. Those are the five objectives I talked about earlier. Providing usable information, systematic access, I'm not going to go through them all again. In so doing, we use real-time surveys of RGUs to ascertain that. But these are, you know, these are qualitative indicators of effectiveness. And other things to think about, these aren't spelled out in rule, but as you think about what is effective, some other considerations we put up there, just to keep in your mind, you know, what is the current state of science and technology? How does that inform this question of effectiveness? The understanding of proposers and public and RGUs and just how the program functions. And is it accessible and accountable, and is it meeting the needs of Minnesota, of Minnesotans? And there's some subjectivity to those questions, but they're questions that we have to wrestle with. So I mentioned a little bit how we do this. We do real-time surveys. We collect some baseline data. We do an annual report, and that'll be done at the end of the year. We'll report back to the subcommittee on that in January. There's ongoing avenues for public input, full board meetings. We hear from constituents frequently. And then there's a number of different program improvement initiatives that we have supported over the years. This next slide highlights a bunch of them. Most recently, we convened an environmental review advisory panel that made recommendations in 2018 as it relates to climate. The good news is we're not really starting from scratch. A lot of good work was done on climate and that interaction with environmental review and some things to think about as we propose some possible changes. So the framework going forward for subcommittees, we're going to, each agenda is going to include some space that's reserved for general input, updates, RGUs, trends, public concerns. That'll be an ongoing feature. And then we're going to make sure you have the technical information you need to make decisions and get your questions answered, both from agency, technical staff, as well as non-state experts and presenters that you would like to put on the agenda. And then staff data updates and reports as they're available. And jumping into today's agenda, as you recall, last month we approved a work plan. Very explicitly in the work plan, we identified climate and health as priority issues to better understand, evaluate, integrate potentially into the environmental review program. So that is what our work plan for this committee is going to really start with. It's not to suggest other issues are not going to be addressed. We're not going to have time to discuss them. This really meant that by establishing these as priorities, where we're going to start. We're going to want to make some progress on this before we begin to tackle other areas. And a little bit of the business case for that, I'm not going to get into too much depth on this, but just to remind you all that the Next Generation Energy Act passed in 2007 established emissions reductions targets that are economy-wide. They apply to all state government. And so when we talk about climate and environmental review, we're really thinking about what is environmental review mean with respect to meeting these targets on a project-by-project basis. So I am going to turn it over now to Denise, who's going to go through a little bit more basics before we jump into climate.
Thanks, Will. So to better understand...
we got a question.
To participate in what projects our decisions make. It feels like we spent a whole meeting on that subject.
So, yes, at a little bit of a higher level. We can, I tell you what, I will look to our subcommittee members to nod if you, we can go through this in just a couple minutes to honor. We just want to make sure we're not going past where and going backwards to some of this stuff, but
yeah.
Let's jump through it. So, Denise, can we do this in 2.5 minutes? Yes.
Okay, so just going back here, just to frame this up, we are aware that there's a National Environmental Policy Act and a Minnesota Environmental Policy Act. They act separately. They have different requirements, and they're implemented just a little bit differently. Some common terms before I start, because I want to make sure that I address any acronyms I'm planning to use, but I'm actually trying not to use acronyms today. But I think I just wanted to explain that an environmental assessment worksheet, the purpose of that, the EIW, is to make a determination on projects that have the potential for significant environmental effect. For projects that do have the potential for significant environmental effects, then an EIS, Environmental Impact Statement, is required. We're going to talk a little bit about the mandatory categories. Those are categories of project types that are required to undergo review, and each category has a threshold, and it has that is applied to a project, and then assigns a responsible governmental unit, or RGU. So again, won't go into all of the roles, but essentially environmental review is a partnership. It's a partnership between the EQB, who has the role of monitoring the effectiveness and implementing on a higher scale the program requirements, but then delegating the responsibility to the RGU to work with project proposers and the public on specific projects. The quick way to think about the EAW process is that there are steps in the process that I actually am doing at a very high level here in your packet on pages 2 through 5. It's guidance on how to step on all the details of the steps in the process. But here, you look at the majority of the process happens in the time that the RGU and the project proposal work together. Once that data submittal is considered complete, then the steps go relatively quickly. And I'm just going to quick run to my notes here and catch up. So I think this is important, and it does talk about why projects take more time, or how the range of time that a project might take is really dependent on that project complexity and the controversy. Some projects can take 2 months, and they can go relatively quickly. And some projects can take several years. And this is another way that the EQB monitors the effectiveness of our program. We rely on a lot of RGU survey data from the time that they get the data to the time that the notice is published in the monitor. But after that, that's data we track specifically from when it was noticed and then when the record of decision is noticed. And this way, we have a better understanding how long it actually takes to go through this process. And the reason that we do this is oftentimes there's a lot of anecdotal response that says it takes too long and there's no benefit. And this gives us real tangible information to talk about what's happening. And it also cues in if a project is taking a long time, what are the elements of the program that we might look at to make sure that we have an effective process. So again, the EIS process.
Um, question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So on the, obviously everyone wants to probably aim for the shorter period of time, but that looks like it's about 1,000 days for the longest period of that, which means that's a fairly, is that based on data of a project going through the process then?
That's correct.
And so nothing's ever gone beyond that, or that might be a project that's still in process being reviewed?
This data was from 2018 projects, so I should have classified that. And we're trying to get at sort of the average here. So it doesn't mean that no project ever has gone yet, but in this data
calendar,
this calendar year, that's what it, and this is just the AW, yes, for the AW process, sorry.
For members who are asking questions, can you just ask my personal concerns?
So I'll add to that, we find that for projects that do take the longest period of time, it's typically related to the controversy and the amount of time that it takes to consider the input provided by the public and respond to those comments.
Is there a distinction here between EAWs and EISs?
Yes.
Okay.
And
in the data, there is. Okay.
Yes.
But not on this chart.
Not on this chart. This is. I just wanted to highlight sort of the typical, most common type of process that is used in the environmental program. This accounts for essentially, and I'll get to that later, but 80% of the projects that are completed statewide is an EIW.
As Denise said, at times the process is interrupted by a legal challenge. Could you comment on that? Where that happens and how long that can take?
So the way the process works is once a record of decision has been noticed in the monitor, then a person aggrieved by that decision has 30 days to file an appeal to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, and they can challenge that decision. That isn't necessarily, this is to the record of decision, not necessarily the completion of the process.
So that challenge would occur at the end of this process?
Yes, that's correct.
And we'll submit a year-end report that breaks this down in greater detail, and we can do more Q&A on that.
Okay, so again, what we talked about, there's two ways to enter the environmental impact statement process. One is the decision on an EAW, the other is through the mandatory categories. There are specific steps. These typically take more than a year and are more time-consuming and more costly to prepare, but they're also narrowly focused. They look at alternatives, and they focus in on the environmental effects that have the greatest potential for significance. They look at economic and social impacts. And again, the decision on an EIS is adequacy. So there is a scoping part of this that talks about here's what we're going to do and how we're going to do it. And then the decision is, did you do what you said you were going to do? So for 2018, here are the projects that are completed. This is just a snapshot. And so in 2018, you can see the most common project types were non-metallic mineral mining, residential development, wetlands and public waters, and animal feedlots. So the environmental review rules allow a government agency the discretion to require an EAW when it is below the mandatory category threshold and not exempt, but they believe the project may have the potential for significant environmental effects. In 2018, there were 12 projects that were either ordered by a government agency using their discretion, voluntary by the project proposer, or the result of a decision on a request by citizens in the petition. So as I mentioned before, EISs are less frequent, mostly because they are conducted for projects that have the potential for significant environmental effects. But oftentimes, project proposers will design their projects so they minimize their potential environmental effects and avoid going through this process. So again, 80%, 78%, of the projects completed were EAWs, and then two-thirds of those were completed by the local unit of government. So I'm going to go to, well, are there any questions about, since I went through so quickly?
Earlier said the ROD can be challenged when it's finished, and at times you'll bring up, well, you didn't consider this item or that item.
Yes.
Is there public involvement earlier in the process where they could say, you need to consider this, rather than wait until the record of decision and then stop it and go to court?
So the responsible governmental unit, or the RGU, has discretion based on the location and nature of the project to determine what type of public process they think is warranted for that project. Oftentimes, if it's controversial, if they know going into it that there are complexities within the community that they would like to sort of bring to the community and as a touch point, they'll host meetings early on and open houses and do outreach. So,
are you asking, Alan, are you asking if there's a public comment period that precedes the record of decision?
Yeah, if there's an opportunity for public to comment before you get to the ROD.
Yep.
There's the opportunity at the discretion of the RGU, but not necessarily as part of the process.
It's required.
It is required.
Yeah, there's a 30-day, for an EAW and EIS, there is a 30-day comment period that's required by rule, and actually there are multiple points for an EIS that, you know, for a draft, a revised draft, and throughout the process, I could bring back that detail. We need to go into that a little bit further. Oh, any other questions about the general? So that's sort of building the framework for the next part of our discussion, which will be talking about giving an overview of the current environmental review program requirements for assessing potential climate impacts. So I'm going to talk about that. And then Melissa Kuski here from the Pollution Control Agency is a manager of the Certifications, Environmental Review, and Rules section. And Melissa is going to walk through some case studies that illustrate the opportunities and challenges for including some of that climate impact assessments using the current rules from an RGU perspective. So here, one of the primary objectives of the State Environmental Review Program is to provide usable information about the potential environmental effects of a project for more effective planning and decision making. Most of the mandatory review categories of projects currently required under the program produce or induce some level of greenhouse gas emissions. These projects may also be impacted by the effects of climate change. Understanding the potential climate impacts both of a project and on a project early in the process encourages project designs to avoid and reduce those impacts. In their discussion of climate, the Environmental Review Advisory Panel agreed that one of the fundamental program gaps for this topic was the lack of a consistent approach for assessing those climate impacts. So, for the federal program, for the federal review program, they developed guidance for that process and how that process should look at climate impacts and greenhouse gas emissions. They recommend that agencies quantify a proposed agency action's projected direct and indirect GHG or greenhouse gas emissions, that they use the greenhouse gas emissions as a proxy for climate change impacts of a proposed action. But when calculation tools are not available, they provide a qualitative analysis and then describe the basis for that analysis. They assume that all greenhouse gas emissions contribute to cumulative climate change. Therefore, greenhouse gas emissions are essentially a cumulative impact assessment and no separate assessment of cumulative impacts is required. That they consider impacts on the project from climate change and how the project will impact and add to climate change, that they use available information, and that their decisions on significance are based on a rule of reason. They use their expertise and experience and judgment and then describe that process in their review document. From a quick review of the other states with state environmental review programs, five of those programs include some level of climate assessment. Minnesota's program includes a mandatory EAW category related to greenhouse gas emission sources and questions on the EAW form that could be used to provide information on climate mitigation and adaptation. Generally, the other state programs that address climate refer to the generation and mitigation of greenhouse gas emissions and require the government agency to comply with climate change or GHG emission policy. So, this is the mandatory EAW category that describes the type of greenhouse gas emission sources that are required to be reviewed under the Minnesota Environmental Review Program, and also sets the threshold for when a project is required to undergo review. There isn't a definition in Minnesota Rules Chapter 4410 that defines stationary source, but typically this is interpreted and applied to align with a definition in federal air permitting requirements. So I included actually in your packet a copy of the Statement of Need and Reasonable, gives the justification and background for how and when greenhouse gas emissions were included in our program. So those changes occurred in 2010, and they were meant to align with state federal permitting requirements. But since that time, the courts have changed those permitting requirements, and facilities are not required to include separate GHG emissions in their permits unless they first exceed the permitting threshold for other criteria pollutants and exceed the GHG threshold. So currently, the Minnesota Environmental Review Program rules have not changed to reflect that court decision. So an EAW is required for projects that exceed a threshold of the threshold of 100,000 metric tons of CO2 equivalent for GHG emissions. Challenges have been raised suggesting that the threshold should be lowered. Some suggest it should really align with the 25,000 metric tons of CO2 equivalent, that is the federal reporting requirement. And others say it should be eliminated altogether on the basis of the lack of a regulatory program that oversees these climate impact assessments or GHG quantification tools. So that's how a program is brought into environmental review. And once it's in environmental review, it's most EAWs and EIS projects use the standardized EAW form. And I've included on pages 16 through 17 and 18 through 22 a copy of the EAW form, but also excerpts from our guide that we provide to RGUs to use that describe how the types of information could be included in response to those questions. So question 16 asks for a quantification of greenhouse gas emissions. Question 19 prompts RGUs to include information on mitigation. And question 20 is typically a catch-all. It's used to address any other issues that have not been called out in any of the other questions. So if there's something specific to that project that really should warrant an analysis, this is the place where RGUs can put that information. A quick review of recent EAW projects indicated that the types of projects reviewed by local units of government did not provide any greenhouse gas or climate assessment. Checking in with state RGUs, the information is mostly in response to question 16 and for sources that would require a major air emissions permit. Questions in the current EAW form ask for the minimum information about the potential environmental effects of a project, but do not limit the information to only these issues. The form is used for all EAW project types and scoping on an EIS. RGUs may ask for any information they feel is relevant and necessary for their decision making and must also consider information provided during the project's public comment period in their decision making. So those are the general program requirements for when a project is required to be reviewed and how the information is provided. But here are the criteria that RGUs use to determine if the project has the potential for significant environmental effects. Now, Melissa's going to use some case studies to illustrate how these program requirements are typically implemented from an RGU's perspective.
Before turning over, maybe just pause. Are there questions about the general program contours you want to ask now, or should we can jump right into the case studies?
Can we turn them offline?
Good afternoon. Can you hear me? Is it working? Okay. How about Okay. Good afternoon, subcommittee members. My name is Melissa Kusky, and I manage the MPCA Certification Environmental Review and Rules section. I'm here to discuss a few examples of how, as an RGU, we've been considering climate and greenhouse gas emissions in environmental review. These are the projects on the screen that I'll be discussing. Please do feel free to jump in at any time with questions. We also have Karen Cromar of our Environmental Review Unit and Dan Card, the Unit Supervisor, here in the audience, and they can help with questions if you want to kind of do a deep dive on any of these projects. But so as Denise had mentioned, the vast majority of environmental review projects generally are EAWs, and that is certainly the case with the MPCA for those projects where we function as the RGU. You'll see on here, I've identified a few different categories of projects because I just couldn't pick my favorites. But I wanted to kind of give you a sense, a little tasting menu of some of the different types of projects we work with. I've identified that subpart 15 project that Denise had mentioned, which speaks to air emissions, and in particular, one that was triggered the mandatory category threshold for greenhouse gases. In terms of non-subpart 15 projects, those required mandatory EAW for other reasons. And I offered two examples there. And then finally, I will address feedlot Daily Farms, which I'm sure no one has heard of. And I'll also talk briefly about a project that's just getting started. We've just finished the scoping process, which is actually a supplementary EIS, where we're actually starting to kind of incorporate more of a climate adaptation considerations into the environmental review. So first, we have the University of Minnesota Combined Heat and Power Project from 2014. This is for construction of a new CHP facility at the existing main plant. And so it has, you know, a combustion turbine generator and then steam capacity generated, and it was natural gas fuel. And so these are the bullet points on the slide describe basically what was included in terms of the climate and greenhouse gas analysis in the EAW. So we have very specific descriptions of all the air emission units and the air pollution control equipment associated with those units. We had a quantitative emissions inventory both for the existing facility as well as for the proposed project, and the greenhouse gas emissions change along with conventional criteria air pollutants and hazardous air pollutants. It included proposed project permitting information, including some accepted operating restrictions that the project proposer was planning to agree to take during the air permitting process that lowered their allowable emissions, including for greenhouse gases. They did include a description. This was going through at the time when the things were changing very rapidly on the federal level, and so they described the changes in federal regulation regarding greenhouse gases. And then it went into a qualitative analysis of combined heat and power systems and their efficiencies, and recognition that they're a lower emitting design and recognized as the best available control technology in air permitting, including for greenhouse gases. There was not any description of greenhouse gases in the vehicle emissions section of the EAW form, but there was also no real meaningful projected increase in vehicle traffic. And so it's important to note, this is an air permitted facility. And that's gonna be kind of a common theme, and Denise had even mentioned that. Permits, facilities that go through air permitting through the MPCA tend to have more quantitative emissions inventory type information associated, of course, with their permitting process, but also it's readily available for the environmental review process. Also, just the cumulative analysis for this project was fairly short and sweet, just briefly described regional greenhouse gas emissions reductions resulting from installation of this combined heat power system, because those are more efficient, because they would be purchasing less power from a utility that serves the grid. And so the cumulative analysis was actually focused on an emissions reduction. Any questions about University of Minnesota? So this was required. This is the Minergy dry mill ethanol production facility. And so it was, you know, a facility intended to use corn as a feedstock and produce ethanol fuel. This was done in 2008. It required an EAW because it was a fuel conversion facility. That was its mandatory category that required environmental review. However, it did also have an air emissions permit. And so we did have a quantitative emissions inventory type information in the EAW describing potential annual CO2 emissions broken down by categories of emissions types and facility-wide greenhouse gases by specific pollutants. It included a comparison of the project greenhouse gas emissions to Minnesota's greenhouse gas emissions. It included a very detailed description of energy conservation methods and efficiencies used at the facility. The vehicle emissions assessment did not include greenhouse gas emissions inventory, even though there was an increase in vehicle traffic at the facility. So that greenhouse gas inventory quantitative piece was really focused on the stationary sources that were subject to air emissions permitting. The EAW also actually included as attachments a report on life cycle energy and greenhouse gas emissions impacts of corn ethanol plant fuel types as compared to gasoline fuels. And it also included as an appendix Minnesota's climate action plan that stemmed from the Next Generation Energy Act. Those were just attachments as sort of a helpful FYI, but they were not directly linked to the project analysis itself. And so the other kind of interesting piece from this EAW is that this project, it included this kind of more substantive quantitative analysis, but it sort of separated it out from the traditional types of air pollutants that we have more frequently regulated, criteria pollutants, hazardous air pollutants. They both came under that question 16, or at the time maybe it was, had a different number. But it was separated out, which is actually not unusual given the year this was done. This was done in 2008. And it was in 2010, 2011, we started to see the federal regulation of greenhouse gases as an air pollutant under the PSD and Title V air permitting program. And so this was kind of perhaps ahead of its time in terms of the way it treated it, and that's kind of reflected in the way it broke it down. But again, an air permitted facility. This is another environmental an EAW that we did. It required EAW for, as a solid waste landfill expansion. It did not have an air emissions permit from the MPCA. And this is reflected in our greenhouse gas analysis is very short, very qualitative, just describing that the landfill expansion produces certain emissions, including greenhouse gases such as methane and CO2. And it describes very briefly the landfill gas management that is part of kind of the solid waste permitting program, describes the passive gas collection system, briefly mentions greenhouse gas emissions inventory reporting that they do, and then the cumulative impact section of the EAW is kind of just a repeat, almost verbatim, of what was in the air emissions impact. And so this is not an air permitted project, and I think that really kind of sums up the theme of what, how robust we see in terms of a quantitative analysis for greenhouse gas emissions in environmental review. Daly Farm. This was just, the EAW was just completed in 2018. It included no greenhouse gas or climate analysis. It works off of the feedlot EAW worksheet, which is an alternative EAW form from the typical that is included in the packet. I don't know, is there a feedlot form in there?
No.
Okay. It doesn't, the questions pertaining to air focus on odor and dust, and it doesn't discuss greenhouse gas emissions in the EAW form. And so it did not include a greenhouse gas analysis. However, on Monday, the Court of Appeals just reversed and remanded back to the MPCA for further review on the basis that we did not consider potentially significant effects from greenhouse gas emissions. So this alternative form from which the feedlot projects operate was approved back in 2000 by the APB, and that's that kind of predates when we started having more substantive, robust conversations about greenhouse gas emissions. But I think the court's decision on Monday, and certainly the conversations that have been generating in the state overall, really lead us to ask the question. This kind of brings up more questions than answers at this point, but what would a valid greenhouse gas analysis for a feedlot look like? And we've just seen different examples of where there's an air permit and there's a really quantitative analysis, and then where there isn't, and it's a more qualitative descriptive.
And the type of permit in this case that they were looking at was MPDS,
right?
So correct. Water.
So the estimations of greenhouse gas emissions from feedlots, we're looking at animal-produced methane, cow parts, and looking at, you know, when you're describing potential controls and looking at different animal feed and how you consider the manure management in that and how that offsets potentially. There's a lot more questions than answers at this point, and I think that's, you know, those are the questions we're going to have to start getting to now as we proceed on this project.
And then under something, under something like this, the stationary versus non-stationary, how would you impact, how would you assess something like that?
There certainly are models and some tools for non-stationary sources, and including for agricultural emissions. Generally, those are more often done kind of on a broader basis, where we look at, you know, the statewide inventory, the statewide agricultural emissions inventory on a project-by-project basis. It gets a little bit more challenging and maybe more nuanced than maybe some project proposers have typically experienced. But there are models and methods and tools. The question is then identifying what's the most appropriate, what provides the most useful information for an environmental review process.
I'm wondering how far back in the production chain do you go when you do your analysis? For instance, with the ethanol plant, that requires corn, and about 40% of the corn in Minnesota is used in ethanol. And the corn requires vast amounts of fertilizer and herbicides, pesticides, diesel fuel to produce it. Do you go back to that? With the cows, they require corn feed that produces greenhouse gases, or you stay only with the end production machine?
Indeed, I think those are some of the questions that we grapple with. Like on the Minergy project, that ethanol project, we appended to the EAW a report on life cycle analyses for these types of projects, but that wasn't really integrated into the EAW itself. It was more of an FYI.
Yeah, just for interest, when I was leaving today, they were applying hog manure to the cornfields that surround their house. They've done it like 10 years in a row, and I mean vast amounts. These 6,000-gallon tanker trucks are coming in like a train. And I don't know what pollution's involved with that, but it smells.
Yeah.
And I would assume it's also giving off methane and carbon dioxide and so on. Is that considered, for instance, when you're permitting a large scale feedlot?
We do consider odors in feedlots.
Yep. Well, come to my house today.
And then finally, the last example I wanted to bring up, and we're still in the process of this project, is for a supplemental EIS for a landfill expansion project. We just completed the scoping of the project, and these bullets here actually describe what I would consider more in the realm of climate adaptation. We've added a 500-year flood and storm event into our analyses of the liner and leachate system and surface water discharge rates and mitigation measures, whereas previously the 2005 EIS for the project only looked up to the 100-year storm event. And I think that's, you know, just reflecting the reality of more frequent large storm events in Minnesota, and I think it's something that as we, you know, continue to see the changing climate, that's going to be an area where we're going to need to flesh out information more on these types of impacts. And so it's not necessarily on its own the project impacting the environment, it's how the environment impacts the project's impact on the environment. And so it's kind of adding a new wrinkle to the environmental review process. So, yeah, this is my last slide, and I just wanted to kind of draw attention to, I think, what is clear here is that there's no one set method for doing these EAWs. There's a big variability of analysis, and I would say number one question is, does it require an air emissions permit? Because that fundamentally changes the nature of the information that's readily available for the environmental review process. And how well, what tools do we have to estimate those emissions? There are a lot, especially in air permitting, a lot of emissions factors and emissions estimation tools and models that come from both the federal and the state government that project proposers have available. Those are less available for different kinds of projects, not immediately linked to that permitting program. What kind of mitigation measures are reasonably available? Only some of them may be regulatorily available, and some of them may kind of get down the path of development strategies and consumer strategies and things like that, but that gets well out of the wheelhouse of the regulatory process and what's an expectation for a reasonably available mitigation strategy being described in the EAW process especially. And then what should we be saying about cumulative effects? Normally, especially when we're dealing with air emissions, we're looking in an area. It's a more localized cumulative effect where we're looking at emissions from facilities nearby. Well, that's in greenhouse gas world, it's nearby is irrelevant. It's a global situation, which means that any one project may have limited contribution to the global situation, but there's still sort of the understanding that maybe it's death by a thousand paper cuts, that all small projects contribute to cumulatively to global climate change. And so really variability is the prominent theme right now in the environmental review world from the RGU perspective. And maybe some of that is appropriate. Maybe it's kind of tiers of consistency might be the best that we hope for at this point, but certainly have more work to do. But thank you, and I'm available for any questions.
One of our questions has been, and that's been brought up, is why do greenhouse gas review if there isn't any regulatory or permit requirements for it? But you are linking it to when there's air permits and when there's MPDES permits required. So there is kind of a link already there.
The information that is useful in environmental review is more readily available when there's air permitting that's also being done for a project. But greenhouse gas emissions information could inform beyond just the MPCA's regulatory authorities. You know, there are other local government and other decisions that get made beyond simply what we have the regulatory authority to address. And so that information could serve useful in a broader capacity. It could serve to inform the public. So that means that could be part of why there could also be a question as to regulatorily what may also be done. Like I said, there are air emissions control technologies that also address greenhouse gas emissions, for example. So
that data would be useful too when the legislature considers, do we need to have additional permit requirements?
Actually, and I do want to also bring it back, Alan, to the objectives and rule that I spent some time harping on early, and that was part of the reason why is to really just reinforce, one of the objectives that's defined is to provide usable information to the project proposer, governmental decision makers, and the public concerning the primary environmental effects of the proposed project. It's not necessarily needs to be a precursor to permitting, but that is traditionally how it works.
I'm wondering about the question of alternative review formats. I took from some of your comments that will it be necessary to review some of our alternative formats as we look towards climate change? Anything you have to say?
I think that's a valid question I would sort of put back to you in terms of what is the most useful. What I will say is, in this court decision that just came out Monday, the court was very clear that, you know, we're not limited to the boxes on the form. And so with or without the form change, there's a reasonable question on the part of the RGUs to develop what is a reasonable and informative and usable package of information in the environmental review process. But in terms of providing some level of consistency and setting clear expectations, mm-hmm. a more centralized, you know, updated form could be an option.
And also, you know, to not answer your question, but just to give a little bit more context, Denise, maybe you can go to slide 23. I think one of the reasons we wanted to give you this information was to just put in a little bit of focus. What are the most active categories of review? And as you think about alternatives, you think about those questions about greenhouse gases, what does or doesn't have air permits? And so if you look up here, there's a lot of activity in animal feedlots, wetlands and public waters projects, residential development projects, non-metallic mineral mining projects.
Which don't have air permits, is that what you're saying? Or all of them?
May not.
The metallic mining. Okay.
Thank you. My question relates back to stationary sources and how that's defined. It kind of gets to what Alan was saying, and backing up what the project use is going to be. So I think of an airport. We look at when St. Air strip is built, you know, what might impact and mitigate that. We also look at stormwater, which is, you know, based upon what's happening on that surface over time. And then we also look at, you know, the wildlife and noise impacts of the planes landing and taking off. How much do we look at, how do we define stationary and something like that around greenhouse gases? So the airplanes are coming in and going due to the stationary runway. How do we look at that? Okay.
That's an excellent question, and I actually did a little bit of research on this, but as you can imagine, the air regulations are a little complex in how they define it. So I was looking for a plain language version of that to share, but so I'm just going to go with a more technical. It's all emission sources on a contiguous property or adjacent property that is one facility under common ownership. So that's how the federal air permitting rules define it. And if you look in the guidance that I provided on the EAW form, it says stationary sources, but all sources of air pollution, except for traffic. And I think there was one other exception. So while Minnesota Environmental Review Program rules are meant to inform regulatory decisions, they're also more broad and provide more broad information to different stakeholders. And so right now, the Environmental Review Program does not define stationary sources. So there wouldn't be anything in our rules that would prohibit or limit an evaluation. I think part of the challenge and what we heard through the Environmental Review Advisory Panel, that they spent a lot of time working on this issue. We convened an interagency technical team that tried to grapple with what this might look like. And you know, there was consensus among these two groups that there is a need for this type of evaluation, this type of information in the environmental review documents. They couldn't necessarily agree on the right approach, what information is needed, how it's to be evaluated. You know, there's complicating factors with how you give credit for offsets and sinks. And so the deeper we went into the specifics, the more challenging it became to build that consensus, which is one of the reasons that we're really excited to be working with you to help sort of create the forum to have these discussions and kind of work through that process for getting us to the what we consider an effective evaluation of potential climate impact. So that's a long answer here. What is a stationary source?
Right.
If I can follow up, just make sure I understand in a shorter way. So you mentioned traffic, but that's under air permitting?
It is some of it.
So I guess what I'm trying to get, so well, you mentioned, you know, part of our job is to look at informing the public, and that's part of the information we gather, whether or not it goes into a regulatory framework. So even air traffic could be looked at as part of that first piece, even though it may not fit into a regulatory framework, it would still begin gathering information and having information for the public to look at.
Couple of thoughts. It's going to cost the project proposers time and money to do these analyses. That's the balance to all this, not just it would be nice to have. And I guess it makes a difference if a permit is needed and you need the information for the permit, or if you end up with lower production of greenhouse gases. But many projects, you're just moving it from one place to another. Instead of the airplane taking off from this airport, it's taking off from this airport. So I'm thinking the net effect is important.
That's one of the issues, too, that the panel grappled with, is how do we consider, what is the framework or scope that's included in that analysis? Is it cradle to grave, or is it direct project impact? Like Melissa was saying, well, you know, that even just the impact from that project might not really inform what's needed for the bigger scale.
And with a net effect, I'm thinking too of a highway that's extremely congested. Traffic is starting, stopping, starting, stopping. You propose a new highway over here and it's producing greenhouse gases, but the net effect may actually be a reduction because of the less congestion.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So you really have to draw a pretty big circle around this if it's going to make sense.
Yep. And the larger you draw that circle, the more complicated it is to produce it. Yeah.
More time and more money
right.
to do it.
Right.
In your question, too, or your point about the burden on local governments or others who prepare this information, definitely came up in the context of the panel and something that the committee wrestled with. You know, I think going back to this, too, I think one thing that there was some agreement on is trying to create some de minimis that, you know, some of these projects are going to have a negligible impact and this is an exercise that might not be, you know, valuable. And clearly defining that and then trying to find that balance of those where there is an impact. What level of rigor and analysis can produce information that it has value to the public and decision makers and balances the cost of timing. And it's challenging.
Yeah, you need to have a set methodology for how you do this and definitions. For instance, with wetlands, the Corps has a definition, DNR has a definition, the WACOBOKs have a definition, and that's relatively simple. You're trying to measure the area of a piece of land. This is much more complicated, and so unless you're going to be just continually threatened and challenged, there needs to be a set method and a methodology for doing this. And I don't know if that exists now, or perhaps it does.
Different tiers of projects and types of impacts. I think there are available methodologies. It's kind of segmenting them out into different tiers of analyses. And then choosing a tool that balances, you know, rigor and accuracy with usability. So there's research to be done. There are options, but it requires more work to look into them.
So maybe, could
you go back to slide 41?
40.
Yeah. So, as I understand the intent, is to get us thinking about these questions. And so I think it is, I read the Court of Appeals decision from Monday and on the Daily Farms case. And if you think about it from the point of view of the considerations you identified, the failure to be clear about the requirement for addressing addressing climate effects has now added an additional step to the process for the proposer of that project. And so I think that's an example of a place where addressing climate impact in advance would have actually been beneficial to both the MPCA and to the Daily Farms folks. And so I see the advantage of us moving forward, especially even though it's an unpublished opinion, you have three members of the Court of Appeals basically saying that because somebody during the issue of brought up during the process the issue of greenhouse gas emissions during the comment period, the MPCA should have considered this potentially significant environmental effect. In that case, it was the direct increased methane production in Minnesota. So there are some, so I see the advantages in us moving forward with a process of thinking about how to include climate. I'm not sure that a new category is the right thing because climate effect could apply across those categories. For example, with land use conversion, we could be thinking about it. I do think, consistent with some of the questions that Alan raised, we have to make some decisions about direct versus indirect effects. So the addition of several thousand animal units at Daily Farms, you could say that's a fairly direct effect in terms of increasing methane production. As Alan was talking about adding an additional road would be a more indirect effect, or adding an additional runway because the reason for the flights is generated somewhere else. I think the other thing we're going to have to be prepared to do is to think about the effects in Minnesota. For example, I'm assuming that the dailies are proposing to add animal units because they think there's, despite some evidence of the contrary, they think there's a market for more milk. And that could be met in Wisconsin instead of in Minnesota, for example. As Melissa pointed out, the climate effect is general rather than limited in Minnesota. So I think we have to, you know, have a rationale for why we're paying attention. I think that probably goes back to the Next Generation Energy Act, where the legislature said, as a matter of policy, we care about the greenhouse gases generated in Minnesota rather than the effect that we have on greenhouse gases elsewhere through our consumption activity, for example. So it seems to me that the legislature has made some decisions about that that we need to explore as we're thinking about this. And I do think we need additional information. And people have brought up the difficulty of calculation and how we can simplify, or if there are ways to simplify or streamline the calculation process, because in the Daily Farms case, the MCA had their view about it, what the additional methane effect was. I don't know if there was, if there had been explicit consideration of that, whether there would have been a different calculation that people would have used, whether the dailies would have had a different number that they would have arrived at. So I think those are the kinds of questions that we're going to need to pay attention to as we look at this. So, you know, it might be useful for us to hear from some of the environmental lawyers at law school who may have been looking at some of these things. I'm thinking of Alexander Kloss at the environmental law school has been looking at some of, I don't know how specifically focused on this, but there are folks like that who might be useful.
So to build on what Commissioner Kelly just talked about, and maybe you can give us a little more background, maybe in this meeting or future meeting or wherever it's appropriate, to the issue of what climate information is needed. I think it's closer to this issue of what's the model, and is there an accepted model that can be updated on greenhouse gas that can be used again and again, that, and maybe there is already, but I have my suspicion that we maybe not don't have consensus around what that model is right now. Certainly we just did some work modeling what it looks like to reduce greenhouse gases in the transportation sector together, and maybe that provides some level of data and information. But without that, and I think about other things that we do at MnDOT, that where we sometimes are asked to, sometimes required to, have a more master study of issues, and then we update that as we go through the process. It seems to me that and I know this is all a fairly developing area of modeling out, but it seems like we almost need that to be able to do this work well. Otherwise, we're going to continue to have pretty big battles about whose model is right. And so we need some consensus around who's modeling, what the model is, who uses it, because if we want RGUs to do this work as well, there's got to be something more agreed upon.
Well, I was just going to weigh in on a couple things. And one, I mean, to this point, I think I would just echo agreement in this kind of concept for whether it's a model or a master's study or, you know, some kind of centralized collection of data that provides that kind of big picture and reference point, but then can be used in the context of a project-specific EAW, because I think that's the tension, you know, we're all kind of wrestling with, is how do you take this really big thing and apply it to something that is very project-specific. So, you know, I don't know what that looks like, but we do have examples of this. I mean, we've used it before, so I think maybe actually looking at some of those examples, both within the context of environmental review and perhaps outside, too, would be useful to this group to think about whether those specific examples work in this context or not. And then I think, you know, the other thing is, I mean, one, I think that helps address to some extent the issue of the question of how different RGUs experience this, but I do think that's something that, you know, we need to dive into a little bit deeper. I mean, this is really helpful in understanding how PCA experiences it. You know, DNR will look a little bit different, but then when you look at local units of government as RGUs, that's going to look very different, and the resources that they have available to tackle these issues, and I think it's very different. So, you know, I think that's something too, is to think about how we bring that perspective into the discussion as well.
So, obviously, I think the reason we have this on the work plan and we came together out on the work plan is we knew that it was a serious issue that needed to be addressed, and it aligns with the administration's priorities towards climate change. So I would agree with everybody around the table that going forward, that this is something we're going to have to look at seriously. As for the you know, the climate pieces that we've been really working on have been based on sectors. So we have the energy system, the transportation sector. We do have a report that we've been working on agriculture as well, that is with the Department of Agriculture, but that probably needs to be to dive in a more cross-sectional work as well. So I think this ties into all of that leadership that's already happening at the state, and will continue to move forward. So, of course, I think just the piece that, you know, Melissa, that you have hit on is, you know, exactly how we incorporate this information into the decision making and the scope of it. And I'm going to rely on the EQBC staff as well as an expert in this to come up with some recommendations and thoughts on this, and certainly something that I want to dive into as well. It's absolutely necessary.
So I have a question for Commissioner Kelleher. So in terms of the issue of bottom up, so part of my reaction was, wait a minute, more greenhouse gas emission is bad, less GHG emission is good. That doesn't necessarily need a complicated model to sort through, but and I think Denise brought this issue up, it's the mitigation activities are more complex and in many cases are based on our calculation of the good they do and so on is based on a model. So I do think we need to have a separate set of considerations related to mitigation activities. Am I understanding the way you made it?
I think that's exactly right. Yeah. The simple answer is, of course, we don't want more greenhouse gas emissions. And almost anything that we do today that revolves around most activities that are powered in some way other than maybe by our feet produce more. So even our mere existence produces more in the world by breathing. We're all contributing. So the idea that the model can help, I mean, you know, this idea of forests as carbon sinks, and there are multitudes of ways that building into the model, what are the sorts of things that have to be trade-offs? It gets more complex because I'm not sure you can exactly, I mean, I'm just guessing here, but from my experience working with models a little bit, I'm not sure you can totally bound the model by the segmented industry, though. And so that's why this is a more complex model. You may have to say, you know, if it's an agricultural use, but actually we'll need reduction in, you know, you can do some things to offset that agricultural production of greenhouse gas, but you may also need to reduce in the transportation sector, or you may need to reduce in the energy sector further. And so I think that's why it's gonna be, we need something here that we can get our heads around to agree on, and for that burden for those smaller units who have to, you know, who either want to or have to take on the role of doing this work, the state has an obligation here, I think, to come up with some sort of model to work with.
Thinking more about the net effects of the greenhouse gas with this dairy, as I understand it, the market for dairy, for milk, is relatively flat. So given that, you produce it in small farms with a small number of head, or it's being produced in these big dairies with a huge number of head. The amount of greenhouse gas may be the same to produce that total amount of milk. In fact, it might even be less with the big herds, where they can be more scientific about it and where they can put together mitigation plans and so on. So it gets complicated in that respect too. You see what I'm saying? If the amount of milk needed, it stays the same. What you're doing is producing it in a big facility rather than a number of small ones, which is better from a greenhouse gas or from other standpoints. Or health, yeah, drinking milk is healthful, right? So that's good.
Well, I think that's maybe a great segue to invite the public into the conversation. I just want to recap, though. I mean, I think I've heard a lot about the complexity of this and the need for more information.
Yeah.
As we go into the next meeting, I think what we want to do is take a deeper dive into strategies, but provide you all with the base of what we have in terms of technical information that can help build out this methodology. And the nice thing is we're not starting from scratch. If there's one thing you get a chance to read at some point, either after this, it's the three-page document that came from the Environmental Review Advisory Panel. It's really a good starting place because it's reinforcing the need to develop a methodology and disseminate it. Yep, this one, for consistency. And also then it reinforcing the need to provide a narrative discussion of a project's climate adaptation planning and emission mitigating opportunities, as well as needing to invite the public into this conversation more to build those things. And so to that end, interagency staff did create a technical team that started to try to unpack what does that look like. So we'll try to bring all that back to you because it does look different in different sectors. Some infrastructure projects, the analysis is more mature. I mean, highway projects is a great example. I mean, the DOT environmental review team is ready at the beginning of January to go ahead and start integrating climate into their environmental reviews already. That's in large part because there is a mature federal project and the numbers are there, a little easier to access. And when you get into, I think what also makes this a little tricky is, you know, Minnesota is only one of five states that have environmental review that governs private action. So a lot of these private endeavors don't necessarily trigger environmental review elsewhere. So we're plowing some new ground, but there's also other states that have that we can draw from. So we will bring that back in a future meeting. So this discussion was really helpful in better understanding your needs and the questions you have. I want to turn it over to the public, but also with any of these questions, particularly who else you want to hear from, if you don't get an opportunity to share that with us now orally, email, offline, or whatever, we just want to make sure that you're hearing from folks who you need to shape this conversation. So.
Well, I had a quick question. Yeah. Did I hear that there was interest in some other, did I hear that there was interest in case studies like Melissa did from the perspective of the other agencies? Did I hear that?
I don't. We can, I think what I was.
I think maybe Mr. Stroman, did you say something?
I don't know if it needs to be case studies, but I think we need to be cognizant that what we heard may look different across different types of RGUs, and so however that fits into the discussion.
However, the illustration of that might fit into the discussion. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And I just too want to reinforce, I mean, our discussion today has revolved almost exclusively around EAW level projects, which is where most of the activity is. EISs have a scoping process where more often than not, this question gets scoped into that analysis and the methodology and how that is calculated. There's a public process for that. And so something to be mindful of, and as we think about program improvement, at least be aware of that. But I think what's driving this is trying to create consistency at the EAW level.
Mm-hmm. If I could just add quickly, thinking back to our earlier meetings and the public involvement from our earlier meetings, it seems that much of the concern was, is the environmental review process adequately considering climate? And that's what we focused on today, and we appear to be on that track. But they were also concerned about, are you adequately considering health impacts? And then I heard from folks, the environmental review is not looking at the most important aspects for a particular project in enough detail and how they relate to each other. On the other hand, they have too much detail on things that don't really matter. So we're zeroed in on one of those things, but we've got additional work to do beyond the climate change, in my mind anyway, is what I was hearing.
That's correct. It'll take a couple of meetings just to address all those questions about that area that you brought
up. I just didn't want to forget about it.
Thank you. Okay, great. Well, we'll turn it over to some public comment now. If you want to comment, please pass in one of these.
There may have been comments, people on the webinar as well.
Kristen, if you're manning this, would you maybe just identify their comments if folks want to speak to them as well? So I have five right in front of me, but I'll just start with Amelia Volz, your Volz, MCEA.
Good afternoon. Make sure everyone can hear me. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Amelia Voss, and I'm an energy attorney at the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. I'm a little reluctant to disclose this, but I was one of the attorneys who litigated the Daly Farms case, so hey, go easy on me. And I just want to start by saying thank you to the EQB and this subcommittee for forming to take up this important issue. A significant part of MCEA's work is focused on figuring out how we address climate change, not just in the energy sector, but across all of our sectors. And so we've been thinking hard about how we do that. And we've determined that one of the best tools that we have, and part of that solution, has to come through environmental review. So I just want to echo that this is so timely, and I think this is a great way for us to come together and try and figure this out. I also want to say at the outset that, you know, it's not my preference to litigate these issues. We're doing better when we think about this as a group, and we have everybody coming to the table and talking about what's going to work. And so I just want to be very clear that, you know, this is a much better process than going through the Court of Appeals. And I think you, Mr. Forsberg, have identified that often, that litigation is never the goal. So to the extent that we can work together and try and figure out how we do this, I think, you know, that's where we are as environmental advocates. So there's,
we agree.
Great. And, you know, and I think that is important to recognize that ultimately we're all trying to get to the same place. We all have a common goal, and it's protecting Minnesota's environment in a way that's fair and works for everybody. I do want to kind of talk about two important frameworks that we didn't talk about explicitly today, but I think that were implicit in the discussion. And the first is that what we didn't call out explicitly is that we have missed our first emissions reduction goal. And that's, I think, really important to acknowledge, but also important to not dwell on it, because we have many other goals and we have a big opportunity to figure out how we're going to meet them, but important to acknowledge. What we did great on was our energy sector. Our energy sector is moving quickly at reducing emissions, and that is fantastic. But when we look at, for instance, the Pollution Control Agency's report to the legislature on our greenhouse gas reductions, what we see is we can't rely just on the energy sector, and so we need to bring everybody else along in reducing these emissions. And that includes, you know, transportation, agriculture, industry. And so obviously the other kind of frame that you all got ahead of me on a little bit was the Seeley case that came out on Monday, the Daily Farms case, where the Minnesota Court of Appeals identified that regardless of what our EAW forms say, regardless of what the guidance says, if a particular project, you know, across industry, if a particular project is going to have potential significant effects from its greenhouse gas emissions, we need to be evaluating and analyzing those. And so I kind of want to echo what Commissioner Kelly identified, which is that as we think about how we solve this, there needs to be a built-in flexibility to say it isn't always going to be this project or that project that needs this analysis. It's going to have to be any project that has significant emissions potential, and that may be a project that we haven't traditionally thought about as an emitter, but we have to keep that flexibility in the system to make sure that we're thinking about these emissions from all of our emitters. So I think from an environmental advocacy perspective, what I see is the exciting opportunity for the subcommittee, and I think what this subcommittee can do is, you know, craft and identify how we're going to do this analysis, but also ensure that when we do this analysis, we're not just checking a box, that this is a two-step process. This isn't just about quantifying the emissions that are coming from our project. It's also about, and I think perhaps more importantly, about the mitigation that we're going to incorporate to reduce those emissions. And I think that mitigations analysis is so key because in many ways that creates innovation among our project proposers to think through, how do I reduce my greenhouse gas emissions? What mitigation measures can I put in place before I even get to the environmental review process so I can help streamline that process for my project and get through this faster? So in some ways, that mitigations piece, I think, is a real innovation tool. And, you know, the goal is not to have this prolonged environmental review, but if somebody is not thinking through mitigation at the outset, we need to incorporate that into the environmental review. The other thing I wanted to highlight after hearing some of this discussion is that I think it's important to keep in mind that mitigations are not always going to be new technology that's out there that we don't know about. There's lots of great mitigations, especially in the agriculture sector, that are old practices and that have multiple benefits. There's many practices that have water pollution reduction benefits and greenhouse gas reduction benefits as well. So part of this is an opportunity for creativity, but part of it is also maybe going back to some concrete land stewardship practices that we've used in the past. I think from our perspective, the best way to go about doing this is to work through the EAW forms and to work through the guidance and to incorporate recommendations into those documents rather than going through a rulemaking process. I think through this Court of Appeals opinion, we have some pretty clear guidance that RGUs have the ability and indeed should be doing this analysis now if this is, if greenhouse gas emissions are present in their project. So I think we also need to you know, recognize that we have tools to help facilitate and help those RGUs determine how to do this, and those tools aren't terribly hard to change. The EAW form and the guidance are ways that this committee can work and to facilitate this process quickly so we're not getting further behind on our emissions goals. Let me just, sorry, I'm going through my checklist of the things I wanted to make sure I highlighted. And, you know, I guess all of that is a long way of saying that, you know, we have the legal authority to do this, we have the ability to do this, and this really is something that we can tackle quickly and expeditiously so we're meeting that next carbon reduction goal in 2025. Do you have any questions for me? Thank you.
The next up is Andy Pearson. And just a note on timing, we have 5 commenters in 20 minutes. We'll try to do 4 minutes each if we can make that work. We're going to try to stick to 3 o'clock.
Great. I'll talk fast. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the chance to speak. My name is Andy Pearson. I'm with the organization Minnesota 350. We work on climate issues. So pleasure to get to be having this conversation here today, and my honor here today to represent our 20,000 supporters across the state with these comments. So, of course, we're gathered because of the criticality of the climate issue, and I know we've all seen a lot happen over the last even just few months, making that issue maybe feel a lot bigger and more pressing to a lot of us here. Our primary connection to the environmental review process comes through the review around the Line 3 pipeline. Which is a project, of course, which our members are very concerned about, partly because of the EIS, whereas, Mr. Seifert, you mentioned just a few minutes ago, there was a public scoping process and climate was scoped in, and they did find that it would have $287 billion in climate impacts, or about 50 coal plants. So we've seen the importance of getting climate review, you know, firsthand. So what do we know, right? We know that the environment is degrading. We've seen hundreds of EAWs and EISs that haven't uniformly identified and set forth these impacts with sufficient clarity to prevent them. We know that this is a time-critical issue, and it demands a major response across all sectors of society, right? We remember that study that said 12 years. It's 11 years now, and it's almost 10. And that's 11 years until we've got to be basically done with this transition, not like we get 11 years until we start. And you know, in our current political environment, right, we all know that there's no federal or international action that's going to like swoop in and do the thing for us here. I really wish that there was. I would love that. Probably a lot of us in the room would love that. But we know that there isn't. And so, you know, kind of passing the buck has been a trend of how government has approached climate for a while, and so it's encouraging to me to be here today to see that this is us pushing back against that trend, and I want to encourage us to continue. So really here to cheer that on today and to implore every member of the EQB to keep going and to do so even faster to try to meet the seriousness of the moment that we're in. So what do we need? We need more mandatory EIS categories that we know. Many of us in this room were at a presentation a few months ago where the authors of the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act talked about how the EIS review was really supposed to be the norm, not so much EAW, with the key piece being the comparative analysis that you get in an EIS that you don't in an EAW. So we know that climate is a far greater threat to our lifestyle than a lot of the other types of degradation on the world scale, and climate impacts alone should be enough to trigger an EIS in many categories. Also, climate should be assessed for every project that has an EAW or EIS in Minnesota, like was discussed earlier, with a common and scientifically sound methodology. And that's regardless of what the RGU, what the RGU is for that particular project. There was a number mentioned earlier, 25,000 tons, in connection with a federal rule to that effect, and that level of emissions should be enough to trigger such an assessment, even if the project wouldn't otherwise trigger review under MEPA. I want to be very clear about that. So we need to be acknowledging the science that climate change demands of us, which is that we need to take a global view on impacts, right? We can't be restricting our scope of what we're concerned about to the geographic bounds of Minnesota, because climate change is inherently global. For a lot of us, that's a new way of thinking. It's one that I'm encouraging us all to get used to, and it's consistent with the science. And my final point here, because I know time's short, we need strong EQB oversight, and we need swift action. And I think one of the things that we've seen over the past few years is that citizens don't always have trust in these kind of processes. And that's an informed perspective on the part of the citizens, because the enforcement is sometimes inconsistent. Sometimes we see agencies taking a lot of action, and sometimes we don't. We see a growing public movement that expects this type of attention more and more. We've seen the examples that were presented today where we don't have those kind of baseline rules about how climate is considered in what way. But I'm here today, and I think a lot of us are, because we believe that we can improve. We believe that it is possible to incorporate this in a good way, and we want to get us to a point where 11 years from now we can look back and say we improved environmental review well enough that actually we haven't approved any more climate-damaging projects in Minnesota. And every major project we've approved is either carbon neutral or carbon negative. I want to put that specific point out there because that is the scope that we need to be dealing with here. That's the scope of action that's required, and anything shy of that is actually not what the science is telling us we need to do as like the baseline to keep the world okay. And so we need to be thinking there. So we're all kind of putting this out here both as the vision and also the challenge. We hope that the EQB rises to the challenge, and thank you so much for listening.
Thanks, Andy. Thanks for sticking to the 4 minutes. Gail Leonard?
Lovely. Yeah. Oh, I'm glad I followed Andy. I'm Gail Leonard. Thank you for letting me speak. This is really fast because I didn't really know what I was supposed to say, but Annie pretty much knows how to say it perfectly.
Oh, no.
So anyway, so I'm just going to give an example of the Enbridge pipeline that I've been, along with Minnesota 350, trying to fight against. Maybe a lot of you, some of you have heard of LaSalle Lake. 2 days ago, Andy and a whole bunch of us were up at LaSalle Lake, which is 4 miles north of Itasca. It is our second deepest lake in Minnesota, 215 feet deep. Minnesota has spent $8.5 million to protect the area around that lake and that lake. It is, according to Paul Stolen, the former DNR biologist, that it is the cleanest surface waters, vulnerable to vulnerable aquifers, wetlands, and a rich wildlife-producing waters. The Pollution Control Agency addressed this specifically, and here is a quote that they said about LaSalle Lake. The environmental damage that would occur as a result of a leak at this location could be massive, and the obstacles to contain we have to look at not only the short picture, but the long picture. I just can't imagine, we really don't need Enbridge Pipeline, that line three. Even Enbridge themselves said at one time, line 67 up there, if they went from 500,000 barrels per day to 800, they wouldn't need line three. I don't want to see them going up to 800,000 barrels either. However, they even stated that they wouldn't even need line three. And Minnesota Department of Commerce said we don't need line three. That's all I wanted to say. I don't have any suggestions as far as what else you think of. Andy pretty much said it all. And also, most people are allergic to dairy because we are the only animal that drinks another animal's milk. There you go.
Thank you. Mr. Doyle?
Thank you. My name is James Doyle, and I live in St. Paul, and I'm also a volunteer with MN350. And I wanted to, Andy Pearson, I think, did a great job of outlining the challenges with Line 3 and climate challenges associated with Line 3. I wanted to go into a little more detail on some of the discussion earlier about the challenge of the life cycle and indirect emissions, the calculation of that. And first, I want to say that it can be done in many instances. There is a wealth of academic literature on this. In fact, our own University of Minnesota has done pioneering work in looking at the ethanol issue. So the life cycle analysis of ethanol, the result of that was it's not so good. But there is that those studies out there that can be drawn on, and I would encourage the committee to seek out that expertise, not just at the University of Minnesota or within Minnesota, but all over the country. But here's a easy case where you don't really need a model, and this is line three. You can take the 370,000 barrels per day of the increased capacity over the current line three. This isn't the total capacity of the project, but the increased capacity. You can look up the kilograms per barrel of CO2 generation, 650 CO2 equivalents, multiply that by 365, divide that by 1,000, and you get 90 million metric tons per year. And that seems to be a bit above the threshold of even 100,000 metric tons per year. So I think that for a project which mentioned already that our own Department of Commerce said that isn't needed, the fact that this enormous climate impact was essentially ignored in the certificate of need proceedings, allowing this project to go forward really makes us complicit in this enormous climate impact. Even if this oil is burned elsewhere, we've just been talking about that, you know, it doesn't have to necessarily be CO2 generated here in Minnesota, but we have to look at wherever it's being generated, because that CO2 in the atmosphere affects everybody here. So it just seems to me to be very incongruous with a goal that stated that we're trying to reduce global CO2 emissions, that this CO2, the climate impact of line three has not yet been taken seriously, certainly not in the certificate of need proceedings. Thank you.
Mr. Madison.
Thank you, Willem. I don't have the chairperson yet, so I can address the chair. I'm going to speak to you today, not from my citizen's role, but that of a scientist. I would like to suggest that the panel's charge by resolution to improve the effectiveness of environmental review use metrics beyond that of process compliance and expediency, as Ms. Wilson suggested, and instead use criteria of effectiveness on the ground as provided for in MEPA in 116B02. If you look at the measure of charge, responsibility, duties of the agencies member to this board, there are metrics there that talk about humans living in harmony with the environment. We don't have to look too far into the news media, technical reports, UN reports, Audubon reports, insect apocalypse reports, to tell us that things are going badly. Over the last 10 years, you may have seen somewhere around 1,000 environmental assessments performed here in Minnesota, 99% of which found no significant adverse effect. If our environment is degrading as rapidly as these myriad reports are producing, there's a problem somewhere. Either we're not looking at the right projects in those 1,000 projects we looked at, and they're not the ones producing the problem. There's some other nefarious agent out there degrading our environment that we don't know about. Or the method by which we determine what is a significant effect may be poorly applied. As a scientist, I strongly suggest, and I'm willing to help you, examine how the criteria of significant effects thresholds are applied. This idea that was Ms. Pesky referred to as death by 1,000 pinpricks is exactly what's going on. If you measure each pinprick, as you do in EAW, you'll say no significant environmental effect, therefore no EIS, don't have to consider an alternative. But if you're considering the 1,000th pinprick, and that's the one's going to kill the victim, you say, well, that's the one that was important. That would be unfair to the project that is the 1,000th pinprick. If you're not willing or able or somehow capable of using environmental review to assess the cumulative impacts of 1,000 pinpricks, then we'll not find any of them and the victim will be dead. All of these reports are telling us the victim is nearing a critical point of viability. Ecologically, climatically, human health-wise, all the indicators are our downward trend is rapid and increasingly rapid. If we don't turn the corner in the few short years, as Mr. Pearson mentioned and the IPCC panel has warned, we're going to go over that cliff. That sounds so dire, so dooming, this kind of thing, until you say, but folks, there's an answer. Environmental review can easily point out that there are alternatives to many of these projects to solve many of these problems. And Commissioner Forsberg, I would like to have a conversation with you about not all milk being equal in terms of its impact per gallon. There are alternative methods of livestock raising and crop raising, this kind of thing, that are more climate friendly than confined feeding operations. So hopefully when the PCA takes on this EIS for this one project, which is one of the pinpricks, that that particular farm is not going to be the one to tip the whole universe over on climate or ecosystem, but it's one of the 1,000. So unless we change each of those from now on, we will go over that 1,000. So let us look at alternatives that both reduce climate impacts, but improve water quality, improve public health, improve ecosystem integrity, improve ecosystem services. The co-benefits of reducing greenhouse gas emissions and meeting climate goals are enormous if you lay them out in front of the public. You may not be able to impose those by denying permits, but you can make the choices obvious. EISs obviously don't make the choices, but if you make the choices obvious, we think society is capable of doing that. But as a scientist, we have not done a good job of laying out those alternatives clearly in front of decision makers and the public. If the decisions are clear in an EIS, the public will hold decision makers and policy agencies, regulatory agencies accountable. If the legislature punishes agencies for doing the right thing, then we can hold the legislature accountable. But right now, we don't have anything that will hold everybody accountable by good science in environmental review. That's spoken as a scientist. In 4 minutes, I can't tell you where those flaws of science applied are, but I would like to engage with you. And that's the final comment I want to make. If your format of this committee is going to continue the business as usual, allowing scientists like Professor Doyle and myself to come here and give you 4 minutes of our expertise, I don't think you're going to be using the scientific community effectively. That's also not good civic engagement practice. You've had great presentations to you on what civic engagement amounts to, and that amounts to dialogue. You're inviting monologue. I get to speak to you. Hopefully your eyeballs are not rolling back in your heads as I talk. But I don't know whether I am communicating clearly. I need to hear your question. I need to hear you probe. I want to then probe your answer. So will this committee in the future use a format that allows for that kind of dialogue and interchange and growing of understanding? Because I've come and spoken, participated on your ERAP panel, and came away extremely frustrated. Why? Because we did not engage in dialogue. We simply stated opposing positions. Your staff did a summary report and then presents an ERAP presentation. I beg to differ that you should build on the ERAP recommendations here. In October, the EQB received a letter from joint sign-on of groups all around the state objecting strenuously to stakeholder-produced panel recommendations. Let's go to a scientific panel of recommendations, a panel that has absolutely no conflict of interest, except that they, one, are here for the public interest and for the integrity of science. If your agency staff people are confident in their science, they will willingly submit their work to peer review. Or this panel, if you would assemble one of scientists, would willingly submit their recommendations to your staff review. Then we have that healthy exchange of scientific peer review. Until you do that, I don't believe your environmental impact statements are going to produce the kind of truth-telling document on which good decisions can be made. So I challenge you to engage with the scientific community, talk to the objective, independent science community about the validity of the methodologies that you're using in your review. I've gone over my 4 minutes. Thank you for being tolerant of my verbosity. I would like to hear your questions.
I've spoken with you about this before, Mr. Madison, about a list of recommended scientific experts.
And I've taken that request seriously, and I've cast about on two fronts. One, you suggested that I cast about amongst retired agency employees, and I'm a member of an association called the Minnesota Association of Conservation Professionals, which is largely made up of retired government employees in natural resource fields. So I have rekindled that interest there. I've also cast out to the Minnesota Academy of Science, the National Academy of Science, the Association of for the Advancement of Science, of which I am a member nationally, and I have gathered information on how to assemble scientific advisory panels for purposes of advising government decision. And I'd be happy to share that methodology and then also be prepared to develop a list of nominees to such a panel if you were to be serious in consideration of having that kind of an advisory panel, even if it's a temporary experiment on the part of this committee.
And would you also be willing to submit a list of experts who are accessible to us fairly locally, whether or not there's a panel, or is this submission of experts that you're offering dependent upon our agreeing at this point to do that.
Yeah, I will not presuppose your accepting my proposal. I would like to have you at least look at it. And the answer to your question is yes. I'm working with Professor Doyle and a group called the Science for the People. And through that network, especially the academic community, looking for people in the field who have availability and willingness, and knowing that they probably have to do this on a voluntary basis to just demonstrate how it could work as an interrelated communication between the scientists in the state and the regulatory bodies such as the EQP. So, yes.
So it would have to be very, very specific to some of the work that we're undertaking here. And you can do that.
That's what I'm trying to do, and I have various people working on that for me. I can't tell you I know all the people out there, but networking, I'm hoping to identify people, one, I have the expertise in the particular area, two, have the time to do that, and that are acceptable to your group and to the science community as well.
Thank you.
So I will just add that as part of a recent meeting that I was at with Region 5 and the other commissioners related to MPCA, I asked this question about what were some successes that they've seen with scientific panels, and so I'm kind of doing my own assessment to be able to get in feedback on that so we could dive into a more specific issue with outside science review. I think that would be helpful.
Be happy to compare notes with what you're hearing from Region 5 as well.
Yeah, they gave me an example of a project, the Michigan commissioner did, of a project on PFAS that they've been working on with standards related to that. But, so I'm really looking at that, and I'll share it with Will as well.
It might be significant to note here that the current administration at the federal level has taken swift action to disband the science advisory panel. That in itself ought to tell you the value of scientific advisory panel. I'll say no more on that. Let it stand for it, speak for itself.
That's why my request was to the individual commissioners of the different states, not to the EPA itself.
And you raise important questions too. And just to, to clarify, I mean, I think there are a lot of different threads that we have to, continue to just explore. One is, project based, this question of independent science expertise on individual project review. What we're going through as a group is a programmatic review. And I think we're going to look to agency experts to put out a methodology and certainly would want input. And so happy to work with you offline to, as Kristen identified, who are those, who are those people that can best advise on that so we can have constructive dialogue. So, thank you for your.
Yeah, on that regard, Mr. Siegfried, I would request that we establish some recognizable common frame of reference. By that I mean, if we can agree on the condition and trend of our current climate or other ecosystem situation that the EQB has jurisdiction over, I'm not sure we all agree on the condition of it and the trend of it and the urgency of response. Andy did a nice job of pointing that out, but I'm not sure we have concurrence about that around the table, so that then from that particular point of reference of being on the verge of collapsing ecosystem and climate situation, then we know where to go, and then whether or not environmental review is a useful tool to change the trajectory of where we're going on those indicators. So I would like to have that conversation as we go forward as well. Thank you.
I would agree that we need that kind of expert scientific help with this, or I do anyway.
Yeah.
But I think we also need to hear from the proposers, because they will have to do it. What are the effects on them? And from the RGUs, because they'll have to implement it. So we end up with something that not only is scientifically sound, but can be implemented and make a difference.
Thank you. On that note, I have one public comment that was submitted online. I'll just read it in the record. It's short. How do we assure RGUs have expertise to review the submissions by project proposers as accurate? And that was from Ms. Jamie Gaither online. So before we close, just recognize the next meeting is November 20. That'll be a full board meeting. We'll be discussing Emerald Ash Boring and pollinators. And so
locations would be determined?
You know, I think we're actually going to stay here for that one. I think we explored some other locations, but given the Environmental Congress a couple of weeks after that and the long travel there, we wanted to manage logistics accordingly. So
that's so far.
You can take us on that tour.
Yeah.
Great.
Okay. Gonna gavel then?
Adjourned. Thanks. Gavel in, gavel out. Oh.